We actually got to ride things this time, which my body wasn't
Good.
happy about, but Tyler was thrilled about. And the photos
What'd you
of me
ride?
before my. Okay, so we rode. The
Did you
first
take some
thing
Dramamine
I
before?
did, and it didn't matter at all,
Okay.
which was unfortunate. But we rode the is it like the guitar one, the Aerosmith one that's by the
Rock and
tower?
roller coaster,
So we
yeah.
rode that. That was okay. It didn't make me as dizzy. Also, why is everything in the dark and inside? Ridiculous.
I,
And
girl,
I know.
tell me about it.
Like, this is why I'm dizzy. And then we rode Tron, which was
First of all, like I would like to ride that ride. There's nothing about it that I would not like to ride. It's just like I know myself now, and as an old person, it would definitely nauseate me.
when I tell, first of all, I felt like every bone in my body was getting crushed by how you have to sit in this thing. Like my legs hurt so much. And then you're holding on like this, but you're pushing, like you're bracing against it. So my wrists hurt so bad. And then I was also dizzy. It was just like whatever. But it was very cool.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to the show. I'm Blair.
And I'm Kirsten, and we are
Mediocre
Mediocre Content.
Content.
And it is entirely too late for me to be doing this after this weekend.
Ma'am, this was the only time,
It is the
okay? And
only
I didn't
time.
want to tell you yesterday when you were at Disney having a great time, and I was like, I don't think she realizes that we're gonna have to record at like 09:30 for her. For the pod, but here we are. So I waited and I was like, hey, I have work today, just so you know. And you were like, that's cool. So I don't want to hear it,
And
ma'am.
listener, if you're curious as to why we do this to ourselves, it's not on purpose.
We're just so good at it now that we can wait until the absolute last moment to do it.
True. It's true. So you're welcome, and
I
also
also
good
think
night.
that daylight savings time has
Oh
helped
yeah.
because now you're only 5 hours behind me as opposed to six.
It's very true. That 1 hour has made, I mean, it's still dark outside for me, but it has made a little bit of a difference. That's fair. Yeah.
So
But yes, Disney Round 2 was fantastic. It's
she's
top
living her
notch.
best life.
I
So
really
just so
am.
you guys know, she's
Oh.
out here going to Disney in her free time. Just like she's one step away from becoming a Disney influencer. We're
Oh,
just.
I don't know about that. I saw plenty of those when I was there, and I was just like, I'm gonna be over here stuffing my face.
Right. No, exactly. No,
No,
exactly.
but it was very fun. It's been very fun. And Blair and I are gonna get to go together next
Yes.
year.
Yes.
So
Oh my gosh.
fun.
We might be giving you guys a live from Disney World mediocre content episode.
Very true. Not that you guys will
So
know that, but we will know that.
we will know it and we'll definitely say it on the pod. So
Absolutely. We, you know what? We could even dress up and like record it. That would be fun.
we could wear our ears and put it on
Yes,
YouTube. Yeah.
absolutely. Okay, well maybe we'll do that.
Maybe we'll do that. All
Anyway.
right. So I'm gonna disclaim and get into the good news because it
Woo.
is late and I don't want to keep Kirsten up past her bedtime.
Hey, it's only in 30 minutes.
Okay, so obviously we're not experts on anything. If you have come to this podcast to get any kind of advice or research that's, heavily researched, we are not the place to get that info. We are not a primary source. We are a secondary source, maybe even a third source. So please, or a tertiary source, I
You
think
got
that's how
it.
you say it.
Yeah.
But we are the place to learn about things that may not have crossed your timeline or your feed. So please hang in there with us, and we encourage you to do your own research.
I will also be hanging in there with us.
Yes. I'm going to take over the good news now
Exciting.
because I can segue right into myself. I don't need anyone else. I am independently segueing.
Independent woman.
Okay. So, real life Rosie the Riveter, Jennifer McMillan, turns 100. For most Americans, Rosie the Riveter, the arm flexing female factory worker in a World War II wartime poster, is a symbol of American strength and resiliency during one of history's darkest periods. But for Jennifer McMillan, a Los Angeles resident who this week turned 100 years old. The feminist icon is more than just a historical artifact. It's an emblem of her life story. McMillan was a factory worker during World War II at Lockheed Aircraft, predecessor to the defense aviation giant Lockheed Martin in Burbank, California. That made her one of the roughly 5 million women recruited by the U.S. defense manufacturers to fill factory jobs amid a shortage of workers while men were going to war.
Huge.
The Rosies, quote unquote, as the women serving on the production lines were called, played a pivotal role in building tanks, ships, planes, and other material essential for the war effort. Their impact on American society was perhaps even larger, advancing cultural acceptance of women in the workforce during a time when females holding a job was associated with being poor, according to the National Archives.
Which is crazy to think about, right?
Totally.
Like, having a job considers you poor.
It's silly gooses.
Silly goose.
Among family and friends at her birthday celebration on October 20th at the Oakmont of Whittier Assisted Living Facility in Whittier, California, where she resides, McMillan shared her thoughts with CBS News Los Angeles Chris Holstrom. Quote, "It feels wonderful. It feels really good. I'm happy that they're here," she said. Seated next to McMillan was her husband of nearly 80 years, World War II veteran, who is himself just a few months away from turning 100.
Holy
I know.
Cow.
They're
That's
so
amazing.
Cute. The couple shared 3 sons and 4 grandchildren. Quote, "We've traveled all over the world during those years together. We've been married about 79 years," she said. "It feels so good to have a companion." Also in attendance was McMillan's granddaughter, who read a letter from a letter sent by the American Rosie Riveter Association in honor of her grandmother's milestone. Quote, "You were a Rosie Riveter, one of many hardworking and patriotic women who came forward during World War II to help ensure Allied victory," the letter read. As for what's next, the sprightly centenarian in true We Can Do It fashion said, "Looking forward to my 150th.
Go get it, girl. Yes.
That's right.
That is literally so wholesome. I love that.
It was lovely. Yes, I thought it was cute.
Girl power.
Indeed. Indeed. Sorry, I had to pause because my cat is literally trying to climb up the window.
I'm going to go ahead and assume it's Jinx.
Oh, it totally is. Of course it is.
Of course it is.
And then Salem is underneath my feet, of course.
Of course.
I think I almost kicked it by accident. I'm sorry.
He knows what he's about.
Jinx is sticking his paw underneath my monitor, like trying to knock stuff over.
The chaos.
I can't.
The chaos, man.
I'm sorry. Like it. It's chaotic over here. They're in rare form. Okay, so the second story I have for you guys is kind of something I don't feel like is talked about a lot, but I wanted to highlight it for that reason.
Okay.
Texas woman gets the world record for donating over 700 gallons of breast milk.
I'm sorry. Can you repeat that one more time?
700 cow. Gallons of breast milk.
Oh, sorry. I didn't even know.
An extraordinary woman from Texas has claimed a Guinness World Record thanks to her generous heart and a little help from some other organs.
Go figure. Jeez.
Elise Ogletree has set the world record for the most amount of breast milk donated by a single person, 2,645.58 liters, or just about 700 gallons.
Good. Sweet Lord.
Yeah. It was a record she had previously broken in 2014 following the birth of her son Kyle in 2010. She was told that she could donate the extra amount of milk she was producing to women who wanted to breastfeed their infants but were struggling. The suggestion was made when the nurses observed how much excess breast milk Elise was producing. She was more than happy to donate and admitted in an interview with Guinness that donating and giving are some of the most important parts of her life. Quote, "I have a big heart, but at the end of the day, I'm not made of money and I can't give away money to good causes over and over because I have a family to support," Ogletree Fair. Says. "But donating milk was a way I could give back. I was overproducing and throwing away milk, unaware overproduction was unique and other mothers struggled," she remembered. "Our first child, Kyle, was in the hospital and I was filling the nurse's freezer. A nurse asked if I was donating, which I didn't know was possible. By the time Kyle was finished nursing, a fair bit after she had donated, 414 gallons to Mother's Milk Bank of North Texas. She would take up the challenge again after the birth of her younger sons, Cage and Corey, such that by the time she finished building her family, she had donated an additional 528 gallons to another milk bank, Tiny Treasures, as well as to close friends in need, though these were not counted towards the Guinness World Record. The Mother's Milk Bank of North Texas told Ogletree that every liter of milk can feed 11 premature babies, which is why her math means that her milk has fed 350,000 infants across Texas if it were all to be used.
Goodness.
Shana Stanks, the milk bank's director, said that they were shocked and astonished by her donation of an incomprehensible amount of surplus breast milk for two fragile infants. Quote, her life-saving efforts are an undeniable testament to her extraordinary generosity and compassion. The Guardian reports that doctors aren't really sure why her body seems to be such a natural lataria, but Ogletree stresses her well-balanced, nutrient-rich diet and proper hydration.
Fair enough. That's probably very true. But also, that's extraordinary. Can I also say that she went with the K names, just like my family?
She did.
Like, bro.
She did.
Why we do this? I was telling you about the Disney children that I met. It was Hudson and Henry. And I'm like, why are we doing this to our kids? Why are we doing
this? Well, Chris is of a family of K's as well.
Yeah. So if anybody's curious, my mom is Karen. Please don't make Karen jokes. Also, then it's me, which obviously my name is Kirsten. And then it's literally Chris, Caden, and Kellen. My
and
gracious.
You think Chris is spelled with a CH, but it's not.
But it's not. It's a K. Surprise.
Yeah. And Chris's mom also did Chris with a K because she wanted it to match his brother, Kevin.
Good gracious. I mean, K is great. Don't get me wrong. Obviously, no. I have to say, as a K owner, it's very fun, but also very hilarious.
Very hilarious.
That's amazing.
Yes. And I think it's like people just assume that like as a new mom, you can produce as much milk as you need to. And that's not necessarily true. Everyone's makeup is a little bit different. And, you know, moms should be able to have resources that they need. And the fact that one mom who's overproducing a super amazing amount is sharing her milk is amazing. It's super good.
It is amazing. And there's a lot of science that goes into that for the children as well as they're growing and, you know, able to feed off of that. And instead of like the infant milk, they have the same vitamins and minerals. But what I learned, and I'm assuming this is true, but if you're breastfeeding and the child is ill or something, like it can change its like makeup to provide extra nutrients or enzymes to assist with that. I think that's true.
And well, so if mom is sick too, her immune system can pass on immunity to like whatever it is to the baby.
Yeah. And obviously this is different because it's being sent to them after the fact, but it's still very cool and very wonderful.
Yeah. It's a cool science. There are actually nurses who are lactation specialists. Yeah. I think you can also be like a lactation specialist independent of being a nurse, but it's just cool. Yeah.
It is very cool. That's awesome. Yeah. Love it. So, excellent job on the good news, Blair.
Thank you so much. I do my best.
Okay. So also good news. So two episodes ago, when we did our Denver Demon episode. We also talked about in that second half of the episode a bunch of other scary spookies that were related to some of the indigenous tribes that were here in America. And the reason we did that is because Denver Demon was really close to all of that and had a lot of history that could be tied to that. We're not continuing the cryptid series. Instead, we're actually going to not be talking about spooky stuff. And instead, since it's November and here in America, at least, we celebrate Thanksgiving. And apparently in Canada as well, which is kind of...
They have it on a different day, though. It's not the same day as us.
Okay. So Thanksgiving is big for us. And that's coming up. So I thought it would be cool and interesting to kind of carry on the indigenous tribe conversation, but less spooky and more about their culture, how they have influenced, how many there are. I forget all the things I put in here because I did this in July, but it's going to be great. We're going to do a refresh together. So this is in no way an extensive pod. There is so much history. Okay. There's so much. I can only gather so much. It's just a skimming of the surface. I feel like I need to really highlight that here because there is such a rich history of the indigenous tribes that are here in North America. Mm-hmm. So if I don't talk about something that you know about, or if I say something wrong or it's off or whatever, you know the drill. Let us know, because this is literally just not even a pin drop. Okay.
And we'll fix it.
That's right. So big historical events that you may or may not be aware of that include or are derived from history around indigenous nations and tribes here include but are not limited to Sitting Bull, Crazy Horse, and Tecumseh, the Trail of Tears, the French and Indian War, and the Battle of Little Bighorn. Those are the big ones that we learn about in history class as high schoolers. At least that's what we learned in high school, my school. And pretty much, unfortunately, that's kind of, it's not a whole lot because there's so many other like pre-colonial pieces that mm-hmm. obviously have carried over, and you know, they have their tribes and traditions and cultures that don't have anything to do with those name brand things that you hear about in your history class. In this episode, I really want to focus on the ancient culture, the ancient traditions, obviously that impact, and you know, the current tribes. And it doesn't mean that those things aren't important, I would also like to say, but yeah. It just means that I can't cover those today and also be able to talk about the ancient portion, which is a little more cool and something you might not hear about as often. So long before Christopher Columbus was even close to here, Native Americans inhabited the North America continent. And that doesn't just include the United States, of course, that includes Canada as well, where we're a unit.
Mexico.
In Mexico, South America, like there's lots of different nations that are now encompassed in that. And obviously when explorers and European settlers did find their way onto American soil in the 16th and 17th century, there were friendships and there were also not so friendly friendships and clashes happening. It's not definitively known how or when Native Americans first emerged from or settled in the Americas. If you know anything about geography, it's so Pangea, right?
Right.
Right. So Pangea, once all the continents were together, there was also a land bridge at some point that connected, I believe, the northern half of a lot of the nations prior to us completely splitting apart. So unfortunately, I don't really know exactly when or where or how. But the most popular theory in general is that they would have migrated from Eurasia across Beringia on that land bridge that connected Siberia to present-day Alaska, and then spread southward through the Americas, of course, over the subsequent generations, which is just how migration happens. The 2021 findings of fossilized human footprints in Relict Lake sediments near White Sands National Park, which is in present-day New Mexico, suggest that a human presence was there dating back to the last glacial maximum between 18,000 and 26,000 years ago. This age is based on a well-constrained stratigraphic record and radiocarbon dating, which I think a lot of people know, it's like a word that's used very often, of seeds in the sediments. So you got layers of sediment, they found seeds, that's how they've dated them. Before that migration across the Beringia has also been proposed to explain purported pre-LGM, which is just that last glacial maximum, ages of archaeological sites in the Americas, such as the Bluefish Caves in the Yukon Territory and Meadowcroft Rock Shelter, which is actually in Pennsylvania.
Wow.
So that's great. And it kind of makes sense, right, that they would start there because, again, even though they would have had to have... Sir, do you want to edit the document? No, that's fine.
Sorry.
That's fine. That's hilarious.
Salem just decided he's taking control.
So if you're crossing from Alaska.
My colored pencils.
Oh my goodness. I thought it was Jinx.
No, Salem.
Bro.
Jinx is up here. He's behind the monitor.
He's just actually
on the windowsill. Yeah. And then Salem has decided to be crazy pants.
I mean, Salem, feel free.
And he is the one who edited the document.
It's fine. He did a better job. So genetic evidence has suggested that there have been three waves of migrants across East Asia, with the first occurring at least 15,000 years ago. These migrations may have begun as early as 30,000 years ago and then continued to about 10,000 years ago. And that, again, is when that land bridge became completely submerged by the rising sea level and, of course, the onset of the current interglacial period. In November of 2018, scientists at the University of Sao Paulo and Harvard University released a study of Luzia woman. This is a 11,500-year-old skeleton of a Paleo-Indian woman found in a cave in Brazil. So again, South and North America. While initially believed to be part of the wave of Asian migrants, DNA and other evidence have shown this to be completely improbable. And instead, using DNA sequencing, the results showed that the Luzia was entirely Amerindian. Amerindian. Sorry, that's hard to
Amerindian.
Say.
Amerindian.
Yes, genetically. The pre-Columbian era incorporates all period subdivisions in history and prehistory of the Americas before the appearance of significant European influences on the American continents, spanning the time of the original settlement in the Upper Paleolithic period to European colonization during, of course, the early modern period. While technically referring to the era before Christopher Columbus' 1492 arrival, in practice, the term usually includes the history of indigenous cultures until they were conquered or significantly influenced by Europeans, which is very important. And this is even if it happens decades or centuries after Columbus's initial landing. So these are like the landmarks. Native American cultures are not normally included in characterizations of advanced Stone Age cultures, such as the Neolithic, which is a category that more often includes only the cultures of Eurasia, Africa, and other regions. The archaeological periods are used for the classifications of these periods and cultures, established in Gordon, Willey, and Philip Phillips, which is such an unfortunate name.
Philip Phillips was a contestant on American Idol, like in 2006.
I love that so much. Such an unfortunate name. But they wrote a book in 1958 called Method and Theory in American Archaeology. And generally, these are the stages that they're considered the lithic, archaic, and post-archaic periods. And these are the timelines that they use to kind of signify what we're looking at overall in the indigenous growth or development, I guess is the best word. The lithic stage, numerous Paleo-Indian cultures occupied North America with some arrayed around the Great Plains and Great Lakes of the modern U.S. and Canada, as well as to the west and southwest areas. According to oral histories of many of the indigenous peoples, they've been living on this continent since their genesis, described by a wide range of traditional creation stories, and other tribes have stories that recount migrations across long tracts of land and a great river believed to be the Mississippi River, which flows all the way through the United States. It's very big. The archaic period, which is since the 1990s, our archaeologists explored and dated 11 middle archaic sites in present-day Louisiana and Florida, at which early cultures built complexes with multiple earthwork mounds. They were societies of hunters and gatherers, rather than the settled agriculturists believed necessary according to the theory of Neolithic revolution, which was to sustain those larger villages over long periods. There was like lots of nomadic tribes in the Great Plains because they had to travel where the food source were. But of course, if you're like agriculturing, you don't need to do that because the food is there.
Agriculturing.
I don't know. I made it a verb. It's late. The prime example is Watson Break in northern Louisiana, whose 11 mound complex is dated to 35 BCE, making it the oldest dated in North America for such complex structures and construction. It is nearly 2,000 years old, older than the Poverty Point site, which I don't know what that is, so don't ask me. And then construction of the mounds went on for 500 years until the site was completely abandoned in 2800 BCE, most likely due to environmental changes, which makes sense because your food source left. Post-archaic period is the final one. So the formative classic and post-classic stages are sometimes incorporated together in what is known as the post-archaic period. And this runs 1000 BCE onward. And of these sites and cultures include the Adena, Old Copper, the Oa Sesi America, Woodland, Fort Ancient, Hopewell Tradition, and the Mississippian cultures. So anyway, I can't dive deeper into these areas. There's a lot of information on these time periods. If you want to dig deeper, feel free. They are very complex and it's very cool to read about. But what we are going to talk about are the placement of tribes that took up 8 distinct regions. The Arctic, the Subarctic, the Northeast, the Southeast, the Plains, the Southwest, the Great Basin, and California is just on its own, which I thought was hilarious.
Wow.
I know. California gets its own.
She's big.
She big. So the Arctic, of course, cold, flat, treeless, frozen. Did I say cold? It's chilly. Okay. This is Alaska, Canada, and Greenland. Okay. This is the Inuit and the Aleut, which I think most people might know the Inuit Indians. So we're like Eskimo Aleut language kind of family dialects.
Sounds familiar.
Yeah. The subarctic is swampy, pine forests, so taiga, if you want to be specific. Lots of waterlogged, cold places. And again, this is Alaska and Canada mostly, but not as far north, if I understand correctly. So it's come down a little bit, and now it's just kind of funky, cold soup. There are two language groups in this region, the Athabascan, which is at the western end, and the Algonquin, which is on the eastern end. And there's a lot of different tribes that are included between those. And we actually talked about a couple of those in the spooky episode. The Northeast culture, which was one of the first to have sustained contact with Europeans, which a lot of people know, stretched from present-day Canada's Atlantic coast to North Carolina and inland to the Mississippi River Valley. Two groups here, Algonquin, which we talked about a little bit as well previously, and then again, more Algonquin speakers. And they were small farming and fishing villages along the ocean for obvious reasons. They were plentiful at the time, and made it super easy, and they also didn't have to worry about necessarily running where the buffalo were or the bison or the gazelle, because they weren't in the plains. They were right on the shore. Very great. Southeast cultures. This is north of the Gulf of Mexico. And then this area is humid, but it does have very fertile agricultural opportunities. So you're probably, you know, most people know the Cherokee, the Chickasaw, the Choctaw, Creek, and Seminoles, sometimes called the five civilized tribes altogether. And they all spoke a variant of what's called the Muskegean language, which again, I think a lot of people are more familiar with that. I feel like that's mostly what we talked about in history. I'm not going to lie.
I think, well, and honestly, I don't know. I remember having a class that was like Virginia history.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
I feel like it just depends on where you live. And that's true. Like everyone gets like the Discovering America story, but I feel like the Native American history is really like region dependent.
Yes. Yes. It is. It is. And it makes sense that we only got a snippet, I guess, in that regard, but also super unfortunate. Okay, so the plains, that's number 5. This area is, of course, kind of a more of a prairie region, and this is between the Mississippi River and Rocky Mountains, so present-day Canada to the Gulf of Mexico kind of area. Before the arrival of European traders and explorers, these were the Suwan, Algonquin, Caddoan, Uto Aztecan, and the Athabascan languages. And they were relatively settled hunters and farmers, kind of a combination. And after European contact, and especially specific to the Spanish colonists, they were actually very nomadic, because the one thing that we actually talked about in a Twitch stream was the introduction of horses into that area. And there was
true.
Like, this isn't specific to what we were talking about at the time, but it was the introduction of horses that influenced the plains. And now there's like wild horses. And then there was like the whole Mexico and America and Texas thing, which is what we talked about in that live stream podcast. So it all kind of grooms together.
Yes.
Lovely. So horses made them much more nomadic because they were able to travel faster than walking. And that's fantastic. So Southwest, huge desert region as well. So present day Arizona.
Terrible airline.
Yeah, I know. Southwest, no thanks. Arizona, New Mexico. Of course, there's parts of Colorado, Utah, Texas, Mexico, present day Mexico. Tribes included the Hopi, Zuni, Yaqui, and the Yuma. And they were more sedentary, while the Navajo and Apache were more nomadic. So it just kind of depended on which group you were part of and what kind of traditions you were also a part of in that way. Great Basin, very expansive. These are the Rocky Mountains to the east, the Sierra Nevadas to the west, Columbia Plateau to the north, Colorado Plateau to the south. These people were the Bannock, the Paute, sorry if I'm mispronouncing all this, the Ute. They had a lot of various dialects as well, and they lived in that little bowl. I'm sorry, can you hear that?
No.
You can't hear the rocking bass of the surround sound happening right
no.
now. Hopefully the mic's not picking it up either. I'm so sorry if you can hear what my husband's watching right now.
Yeah, I don't hear it, but okay. I don't know. Salem just knocked over one of my Legos. So. Perfect. And then Jinx is laying on the floor.
It's just chaos outing. Tonight.
It's chaos.
Ugh. All right. Well, something else that's chaos is California. So we'll do that one now.
Okay, great.
Okay. This is the last one that they've identified in terms of how many that they kind of break out. So before European contact, the temperate California area had more people than any other North American landscape at the time, with approximately 300,000 people in the mid-16th century. These languages were derived from the Penutian, the Hokan, the Utu Aztecan, and the Athapascan. And sorry about the pronunciation. Basically, this is so super important, because to see that they inhabited not just a section, not just one area, they were going the whole scope of North and South America. And the reason this is important is because once those European settlers did come in, these cultures and traditions were already established, from spiritual values to food to, you know, their what's the word I'm looking for, like their ceremonies, music, art, all of those things would not just stay with them but influence as we grow into modern era and even today. So all of that's super important, so you can see the vastness and the greatness of all the different cultures. But when we come back, we'll talk about all those influences and how we see them today and where we see them today.
Hello, this podcast is sponsored by the Tooth Fairy, Santa, the Easter Bunny, Dracula, the Keebler Elves, Jack Frost, Bugs Bunny, Winnie the Pooh, Bigfoot, and the Loch Ness Monster.
Thank you for your continued support. If you are interested in sponsoring mediocre content, please contact us by Owl or Seance. No, but really though, you can contact us at mediocrecontentpodcast@gmail.com, on Twitter at mediocresquawks, or Instagram at mediocrecontentpodcast. Also, if you like these fake ads, or if you're sick of them and want real ads, rate us 5 stars wherever you listen to podcasts.
Now back to the show.
Welcome back. We certainly did not just take the last 10 minutes to show pictures of our cats.
Was it 10 minutes? I feel like it was more like 20 minutes.
Who's counting? It's fine.
We were literally just holding them up to the screen. Like
Like, we don't
like old people
text. Well, I was like, if I was sitting next to you, I wouldn't text them too.
Right. Like, no, like, exactly.
Yeah, it's fine. Anyway, what they weren't doing in indigenous cultures was sharing photos. Anyway,
that's a terrible transition.
Well, it's also probably untrue because they did have cave painting, so kind of true. You know, maybe they did.
But of cats, though, I feel
I don't know. Didn't we do an episode on the history of cats? It was like one of our first ones.
We did. Do I remember anything from that episode? No. Because that was 3 years ago.
Oh, now I feel weird.
I know.
We're going to skip along that crisis and go straight into what I got. Okay, so modern, today, as we speak, right this moment. Okay. There are 573 federally recognized tribal governments and 326 Indian reservations in the United States. That doesn't include Canada, doesn't include Mexico, doesn't include any of that, just the USA. These tribes possess the right to form their own governments, to enforce laws, civil and criminal, within their lands, to tax, to establish requirements for membership, to license and regulate activities, to zone, I don't know what that means, and to exclude persons from tribal territories. They've got,
I think zone means like planning for their land. So like zoning for like shops or housing or things like that. I think
you heard it here, folks. This is what zoning means. And also that's a lot of stuff that you can do with your own little government. So it's like government inside of a government. Mm-hmm. There are limitations. So limitations on tribal powers of self-government include the same limitations applicable to states. So that's kind of how they function. So, for example, neither tribes nor states have the power to make war, engage in foreign relations, coin money, blah, 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 blah. Okay. But you can kind of govern yourself within the umbrella of the federal government if you're looking at it like that.
Okay.
Additionally, there are a number of tribes that are recognized by individual states but are not federally recognized. The rights and benefits associated with state recognition, of course, vary from state to state, and they also vary from state to federal recognition. So that's just a little, you know, I don't know, penny for your
administration
thoughts.
There you go. Situation.
Yes, we've ironed that out. So now on to the fun stuff. Spirituality and values. So life and oral traditions of Native cultures in North America offer rich and ancient spiritual insight. And sorry about that. Despite the enormous diversity. I hit my mic. Despite the enormous diversity. Also, sorry, I'm going to start that sentence again. What you don't understand is while we're sitting here talking, we're using our hands as if you can see us talking animatedly.
No, it's so true.
What we're talking about. And the mic is right next to our face. So sometimes I just whack it because I'm just so expressive.
Yeah. Okay.
Round three. Despite the enormous diversity between the hundreds and hundreds of tribes that made their home in North America, many actually share some common spiritual understandings. They did not think of religion, which is in quotes, as a distinct element of their larger life as a culture and community. Instead, they thought of all life, every task, every ceremony, every community gathering, relationship, human, non-humans, the whole thing, that are a larger sacred story. The spiritual and the physical are not separate. Instead, they're interwoven, interacting with each other. Examples of this: the cosmos is a living womb that sustains all life. All of life is animated by a spiritual force, which is called the Great Spirit, and human beings are responsible for caring for and respecting all of creation. Beautiful.
Not my favorite use of the word womb, but that's fine.
I don't know how many you could possibly have, but I'm sorry I didn't make the list. Physical places and objects are powerful and sacred. Native cultures have a strong sense of importance of space, place, and objects, and these things are alive with spiritual energy and making them a crucial part of spiritual and communal life. Life and spirituality take place in the context of community. Each member of the tribe is born into a specific set of responsibilities, relationships, and customs, and your actions, thoughts, and energy and relationships impact the tribe around you. Of course, the health and life of each individual can help or harm the community as a whole. And then finally, Spiritual traditions are, of course, passed down through the generations. So you got your history, the belief, the tradition. Each tribe teach to their children at the young age so that they're kept alive through storytelling. And in this way, spirituality is deeply ingrained within the tribe and then, of course, preserved over time, which is super important. Some tribes include the use of sacred leaves and herbs, specifically tobacco, which again, I feel like is kind of commonly discussed because it ended up being a cash crop for America. So it was very important and relevant, but it was also very important and relevant well before then. Also sweet grass or sage, which I feel like people are,
I like sage.
Yeah, people are very knowledgeable on as well. These were used for a lot of these traditions. Many plains tribes have sweat lodge ceremonies, though the specifics of the ceremony vary among tribes. It's mostly encompassing fasting, singing, prayer in ancient languages of their people, drumming, of course. There are lots of different types, but they all kind of relate to each other in a way. Another significant religious body among Native peoples is known as the Native American Church. It is a syncretistic, which is a word I've never had to say before, church incorporating elements of Native spiritual practice from a number of different tribes, as well as symbolic elements from Christianity. So they've kind of taken that old tradition culture and interwoven it into a, I wouldn't say modern, but European, I guess.
Yeah.
Yeah. Belief system. So they've merged those together. The main rite is what's called the Piote ceremony. Prior to 1890, traditional religious beliefs included the Wakan Tonka. In the American Southwest, especially New Mexico, a syncretism between the Catholicism brought by Spanish missionaries and the native religion is common. Religious drums, chants, and dances of the Pueblo people are a regular part of the masses at Santa Fe's St. Francis Cathedral. Native American Catholic syncretism is also found elsewhere in the U.S., in New York specifically. There's a couple of different areas. And some American Native American tribes who practice Christianity, including the Lumbee, organized demonstrations such as the Lumber River Conference of the Holiness Methodist Church, which is a mouthful, but very cool. There's also the Eagle Feather Law. And if you want to get specific, that's Title 50, Part 22 of the Code of Federal Regulations. This stipulates that only individuals of certifiable Native American ancestry enrolled in a federally, not state, recognized tribe are legally authorized to obtain eagle feathers for religious or spiritual use. This does not allow Native Americans to give eagle feathers to non-Native Americans. And this is important because the eagle, if you don't know, is the national symbol for the United States. Yep. And they are also, I don't know if they still are. I'm assuming they are, but they are on the endangered species list, or they have.
I don't think they are anymore.
Okay, great. So they've, you know, they're very abundant. We actually,
they were when we were kids, but yeah. I think they've since come off.
Perfect. So, but they're also a national bird. So you don't want to be shooting those things down anyway, but
nope, they're really big too.
Yeah. They're huge. But yes, because it's specific to their tradition and their religious culture and spirituality and all those things, they do have specific rights that are recognized federally.
Right.
Moving on to music culture, which I feel like is kind of intertwined with spirituality a little bit because, you know, you have the drumming, you've got lots of different song and music that's happening during these different ceremonies that they have, but it's mostly entirely what's called monophonic, and this just means one texture or non-accompanied. Of course, there are exceptions to this rule. Native American music often includes drumming, like we talked about. It also includes rattles or other percussion specific instruments, but often that's kind of it, other than their voices, of course. Flutes and whistles made of wood, cane, or bone can be played, generally by just individuals, but in former times also by large ensembles. So it just kind of depends. The most widely practiced public musical form among Native Americans within the U.S. is that of the powwow, which I think, again, a lot of people are familiar with.
Yeah.
At these gatherings, specifically, there is the annual gathering of nations in the Albuquerque, New Mexico area. Members of drum groups will sit in a circle around a huge drum, and these drum groups play in unison while they sing in the native language, and dancers in the colorful regalia dance clockwise around the drum groups in the center. Familiar powwow songs include honor songs, intertribal songs, and crow hops, sneak up songs, grass dances. There's tons of different ones that they display while they're there. And most indigenous communities in the United States will also maintain their traditional songs and ceremonies, some which are shared and practiced exclusively within their communities. Art is another huge impact. So generally, Native American art comprises a major category in even the World Art Collective. And of course, their contributions include pottery, paintings, jewelry, weaving, sculpture, basketry, carvings, the whole kit and caboodle, if you will.
Yes.
The Iroquois living around the Great Lakes and extending east and north used strings or belts called wampum that served dual functions. Mm-hmm. The knots and beaded designs mnemonically chronicled tribal stories and legends. So it's kind of like a timeline, and further served as a medium of exchange and a unit of measurement. So freaking useful.
Cute.
Pueblo people crafted impressive items associated with their religious ceremonies. Kachina dancers wore elaborately painted and decorated masks as they ritually impersonated various ancestral spirits. These people were also particularly noted for their traditional high-quality pottery, often with geometric designs, floral, animal, and bird motifs. Sculpture in general, though, was not highly developed. However, carving out of stone and wood were made for religious uses. And then they had superior weaving, embroidery, huge dye collection. They all characterized what's known as the textile arts, which are very much influenced in the regalia that a lot of these tribes wear as well during their ceremonies. And then I feel like another common thing is turquoise and shell jewelry. I think a lot of the times you associate with that because at least in the Western states of the United States, that's where a lot of it was mined also. So turquoise and things were very helpful because you could find it pretty easily. And also you could put it in really fancy jewelry and headgear and, you know, be very pretty.
Yes.
And then finally, in the music category, the Navajo, spiritually focused on the maintenance of harmonious relationship with the spirit world, often achieved by ceremonial arts, and they would incorporate sand painting. For the Navajo, the sand painting is not just a representational object, but a dynamic spiritual entity, because again, everything flows and is interconnected together. It was considered to have a life of its own because of that, which helped the patient at the center of the ceremony reestablish a connection with that life force. So nice. More of like a healing ceremony, so to speak. The last thing I want to talk about is one of my favorite things, because all of that's super fine, well, and good. But have you heard about food? Food is great.
Food is great.
And there was a lot of influence on food. So as much as 3/5 of the world's agricultural crops actually originate in the Americas, without the Colombian exchange, there would be no tomatoes for Italian food, no hot chili peppers for Indian cuisine, and no dietary staples such as potatoes, squash, beans, or corn. I feel like corn is usually the one we talk about, though.
Corn.
I do love corn. Historical diets of Native Americans differed dramatically from region to region for obvious reasons, because it just depended on what was available. And different peoples might have relied more heavily on agriculture, horticulture, hunting, fishing, or gathering wild plants and fungi. And this also meant that the tribes were able to develop these diets based on their environments, but also ones that were well suited for their environments.
Mm.
For example, those that were near the Alaska area fished, hunted, and harvested wild plants. But you can't really, it's frozen for the majority of the year. So you're not really farming up there, you know? Coastal people, however, you got sea mammals, fish, fish eggs, lots of different seafood. But if you're inland, you're going to have bison, caribou, moose. You're not going to be able to fish in the middle of a forest unless you find a lake, which does happen.
It does.
But we're talking about the majority here. Also, in certain areas, you may be preserving things. So smoked or dried meats, which is super helpful. So I guess that version of jerky. I don't know. I like jerky. It's that version. And then trying to get outside of just the coastal area, we talk about canoes, dugout canoes specifically. I feel like that was also something we talked about a lot in history class.
Definitely.
In the eastern woodlands, very agricultural. And by 1800 BCE, there was lots of crops that were developed for eastern agricultural complexes, including those squashes. There was also sunflower, goosefoot, which I don't know what that is, but it sounds funny. And then marsh elder. They were great. Desert regions. So again, Arizona, California kind of area. This relied heavily on what was known as the teperi bean. This and other desert crops, mesquite bead pods, tunas, which is not the fish, it's a prickly pear fruit, challah buds, saguaro cactus fruit, and acorns, very popular. In the Southwest, we've got irrigation, which is great for agriculture. So they had storehouses with grain, protection against frequent droughts. You know, you just adapt, is I guess what the long story of all of this is. But the one that everybody talks about is, of course, maize or corn. And this was first cultivated in what is now Mexico, and it was traded north in the Southwest area as well. From there, it spread across the Great Plains, Eastern Woodlands. Native farmers practiced polycropping maize, beans, and squash, and these became known as the Three Sisters, which is kind of cute. The beans would replace the nitrogen, which the maize leached from the ground, as well as using corn stalks for support for climbing. And then the deficiencies of a diet heavily dependent on maize were mitigated by the common practice among Native Americans of converting maize kernels into the hominy, called nixtamalization.
Cool.
So they had a system, kind of worked. It's like rotating crops. They did is they rotated crops, you know,
yeah,
and kind of set the stage for that, which was really great so that you didn't just deplete all the natural resources you were giving back to the ground. It's all holistic. It goes back to the whole interconnectedness, and it's lovely. Agriculture gender roles of Native Americans varied from region to region. They mentioned it in the article that I picked up, so I felt it was maybe just interesting to note. In the Southwest area, men prepared the soil with hoes, while the women were in charge of the actual planting, weeding, and the harvesting portion. In most other regions, though, the women were in charge of the agriculture up to clearing the land as well. Clearing the land was, of course, an immense chore since they rotated the fields, so that's a lot of work. And with all of that work, that's all I have time for. And also, everything is after that is like European influence, which, you know, we could talk
right.
about, and we'll probably have to do a separate episode if we want to. But that would just span from the setup all the way to what the Europeans and the connections of all of those were. So, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
Summary so, of the Native American culture.
That was a lovely summary, I feel. Yeah, I think that was lovely.
I mean, if you've never been to America and you've never experienced some of these things and you haven't learned about them, it's actually very fun and interesting.
Yeah.
And there are modern, like I said, there's like 500 something that are federally recognized and even state recognized.
Mm-hmm.
So it's not even like this is a past thing. This is a current modern era thing. And they still do their cultural traditions. They still have generations that are carrying on all of those pieces, which is really important and really great.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Yeah.
All right. Well, I'm trying to sit here and think of a corn pun, but I don't think I can. But that wraps up this episode of Mediocre Content. Feel free to send us an email with any questions, comments, concerns, episode topic suggestions, or anything else that your little heart desires.
Like corn puns.
Because clearly I'm fresh out. at mediocrecontentpodcast@gmail.com. Follow us on Instagram or TikTok at mediocrecontentpodcast, or catch up with us every other Tuesday. Just kidding. Not really. I can't read. We will not be on Twitch is what I was about to say. Yeah. So we'll keep you posted, but definitely TikTok and Instagram. That's where we live most of the time. If we're not on your, any place that you listen to podcasts. So don't forget to rate us 5 stars, and we will see you next week. Okay. Bye.
This has been Mediocre Content.
Thanks so much for listening. Cheers.
Cheers.